Actually, I'm proud that Ms. Magazine published a British travel author who was a male to female writer, wonderful writer, and who wrote a wonderful article for us called A Spy in the Ranks, because as a man, he had been in the British Army. And with to be there with a woman's sensibility, you know, created a wonderful article. I think what the concern was that couldn't we create a society that accommodated unique individuals and not make the individuals adapt to society, if you see what I mean. But we support each other's choices along the way, you know, because we're clearly not there yet. Mm-hmm. I do think it's very helpful. Anything that interrupts the gender binary is very helpful. And anything that points out that both gender and race are inventions, are cultural inventions, is very helpful. At the same time, we have to recognize that we are, I think, the only animal that is born with such an undeveloped, yet-to-be-developed brain. You know, so like something like 80% of our brains develop out of the womb. So we're, the good news is that we're adjustable, and the bad news is that we're adjustable. So both gender and race, because we grow up in an atmosphere in which they matter, but they are still cultural inventions. And I've been greatly helped by learning ever more about Indian country, that is what was here before Europeans arrived, because many of those languages, Cherokee and other, like a lot of the other old languages, didn't even have gender. They didn't have gendered pronouns of he and she. A person was a person. What a concept. You know? So I think that sometimes what is most discouraging to us is that we think the way it is attributable to human nature. So it's very helpful to find out that it wasn't always that way, and indeed most of human history was different. So, you know, all of those things I think are helpful, and we need to look at behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, who is kind? It's much more important to me than what their gender is, right?
So are there occasions in your life where you think that, like these learning opportunities that you were talking about with the Indian nations here in the United States, where you've your perceptions have been changed?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the main change for me has been realizing how deep it goes. Mm. You know, I think in the beginning I had this very crazy idea that, oh, this is so unfair, certainly if we just explain it to people. You know, I mean, I didn't understand the depth of the interested power centers. So, and that was true everywhere, you know, say with the Equal Rights Amendment, I thought if we got the majority of Americans to support it, which we did, that it would pass. I didn't realize that much of the insurance industry had their actuarial tables rated by sex. Mm. And therefore, we were defeated by the insurance companies. Does that make sense? I mean, because mm-hmm. it would have cost them a lot of money to change. I didn't fully realize that. And I think I didn't fully realize that controlling reproduction was the whole ballgame. You know, that's what it's all about. Mm-hmm. And therefore, controlling women's bodies is what it's all about. I didn't really get the depth of that and the degree to which it is intertwined with racism and class, and so, because you can't perpetuate race unless you control reproduction. You can't perpetuate classism and other hierarchies unless you control reproduction. So I think a lot of people still don't, because people say to me, why are we still fighting the battle about family planning and abortion and something? You know, mm-hmm. And the reason is, it is the most fundamental basic issue. I've learned that with pain over time, but it just has lengthened the time span. It hasn't told me that there's anything less logical about just saying, hello, we're going to control our own physical selves. How about that?
So something that our class has talked a lot about is intersectionality. You've previously been quoted saying that all progressive activist groups have to be unified under one banner, like climate change groups, groups that advocate for civil rights, for class equality, LGBTQI rights. What do you think is the biggest obstacle that we face in the unification of these groups?
Well, I wouldn't say we have to unify under one banner, because I think there's a progression. You know, first we become visible as a group and we get to name ourselves, and then we tell our stories and we organize together. You need that visibility, you need that individuality, and then at a certain point you're strong enough and it becomes clear that you can explore the connections, you know, as with race. You know, you can't perpetuate racism unless you control women's bodies. So obviously those two things are completely connected. And sometimes on campus, somebody will say to me, well, why are the same groups against lesbians and birth control? Which seems to them sort of illogical. But it actually is logical. Because the more authoritarian right-wing groups are saying that sex is only permissible and okay when it can end in conception. So obviously they are against love between two people of the same sex as well as against contraception. So those things are become more clear and deeper as time goes on. I'm trying to think of something. Well, here's something that we were just talking about that is surprising to me, and that is that in my generation, you know, we felt that we became who we married, you know, and we couldn't really plan ahead because the needs of our husbands and our children would. And now we were just talking about the fact that that young women are now made to feel they have to be successful on their own before they're 30. I never anticipated that. That sort of came around the corner. And it's just not true. It's just not true. I didn't, speaking for myself, I didn't even know what I really loved and wanted to do until I was 40.
That's encouraging. So just to switch gears a little bit, feels that we live in a culture today where if you, as a woman, act too traditionally feminine, you're perceived as weak. If you act too traditionally masculine, you can be called bossy. Can you hear me? And if you act or dress too sexually, you can be called a slut. So how do we rectify these tensions and recognize the strength in any expression of gender?
Well, I'm tempted to say, when they call you a slut, say thank you. It so confuses people when they insult you and you say thank you. You know, I just think we have to say, oh, that's interesting you feel that way, and go right on. I mean, you know, we can be whoever we want to be. We should be allowed to explore whoever it is that we are and want to become. You know, being a woman is performance. Being a man is content and substance to a greater degree, although it's some performance too. So, you know, I just think we have to challenge the performance all the time and just say, and not challenge for the sake of challenge necessarily, because then you're paying attention to this restriction by disobeying it, you know, you're honoring it by saying no, but just by not giving in to it.
Thank you. And another topic that we've been talking about that's been in the news lately is the recent Columbia student Emma Sulkowitz, and who's also a rape survivor, who vowed to carry her mattress around campus until her attacker was expelled or until she graduated. And her graduation came first and her attacker was never expelled. Do you see this as a effective way to raise awareness about sexual assault on college campuses?
Yes, absolutely. I thought it was a brilliant political act, performance art act. I admired it very much, and I don't know anybody who didn't, actually.
Do you think there are ways in which we can do better in terms of awareness of sexual assault and also the ways that we deal with it on college campuses?
No, yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure that you've been seeing the documentaries and the exposés of, you know, 1 in 5 women is sexually assaulted on campus. I hope and believe that this campus is a big exception to that statistic, even though I'm sure it's not without tensions and problems and so on. Part of the struggle is making those institutions responsible for proper reporting. You know, up to now, or up to recently, campuses were concealing sexual assaults because they thought it blackened or negated the reputation of the campus. And I think now they're more likely, at least we've been trying to say to them, look, you know, people want to go to honest campuses. If you don't go to a campus that says there's no sexual assault on campus, that just means they're being dishonest about it and probably don't have proper procedures to deal with it. It's getting much better, but we haven't really gotten to the gender, the masculinity, the fraternity parties, the civic, you know, I mean, the we're dealing with the symptoms, and we haven't yet really dealt with the disease.
So just to switch gears, in 1969, you wrote a piece for Look magazine called Why We Need a Woman President in 1976. And it's 2015 now. And in 2008, you also wrote an op-ed to arguing that sexism is even more restrictive than race, especially in the parallel between Obama and Hillary Clinton. So what's your outlook on the prospect of having a woman president in 2016, and do you think that candidate is still Hillary Clinton?
You know, I would not say sexism. I would never... There's no competition of tiers. Mm-hmm. I would never say that sexism is more important than racism. Each situation is different. It did seem clear to me the last time that Hillary Clinton ran that she could not win. Mm-hmm. And I think it was just too soon. But what was the great tragedy of 2008 to me was that the press kept saying, which is more important, sex or race? Hello? What does that mean? Mm. What's more important, air or water? I mean, you know, and that leaves out women of color. I mean, the most tragic thing about that election was that we had two candidates who were almost identical on the issues, who were actually friends, who were colleagues, and, you know, suddenly they got put in this place by the media. Mm-hmm. And for the whole first year of the 2008 campaign, reporters would say to me, who are you supporting, Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama? And I would say, yes. Now I think she could win, because I think she herself and a lot of other women have given us an image of women in that kind of position of authority, so it doesn't seem so impossible anymore. But I don't think it's going to be completely changed until men are raising children as much as women are. Because most of us are raised mostly by women, including women, we come to feel that female authority is appropriate to childhood and the home, and less appropriate to the world outside, where we see male authority. And that goes deep in us. So I really, you know, Dorothy Dinnerstein, you know, do you read Dorothy Dinnerstein? Who wrote a book called The Mermaid and the Minotaur. I recommend it to you, because she's talking about old cultures in which men played a role in child care and so on, and how much less violent they were, because that allowed men to develop all of themselves, their full humanity, in the same way that women do by going outside the home and so on. So I think we haven't gotten to the real deep solution yet, but it is now possible, I think, maybe. Although she's going to take an incredible amount of shit between... It's like Snow White and the 20 Dwarfs right now. That's right.
So we're going to open it up to the audience. We have one more question. And you already touched on this, but you've said before that there shouldn't be a need for a word for feminism, and one day there won't be. So could you elaborate more on this future that you imagine where we won't have the need for feminism?
I don't know if I can fully imagine it, but what helps me is to look at the past. When on this land where we now are, there was a member nation of the Iroquois Confederacy, I'm not sure which one, and women could sort of did most of the agriculture, men did most of the hunting and so on, but those things were equal, and also they were porous. You could go back and forth. Women controlled their own bodies from, and therefore controlled reproduction. You know, and the same, if you look in India at the Dalits, if you look in Africa at the Kwe and the San, where we all came from, every one of us came from Africa, from, you know, the Kwe and the San and the original inhabitants of Africa, there were not gender roles like there are now. And there was shared raising of children, and there was a consensus forms of government. Actually, our constitution is somewhat based on the Iroquois Confederacy, if we would just admit it. Even though the two Iroquois advisors who went to Philadelphia at the invitation of Benjamin Franklin, the first thing they said was, "Where are the women?" So it helps me. I don't know what it's going to look like in the future. The futurists are too authoritarian for me. They keep on telling you what your future is going to be like. I don't think we know. It's kind of organic. But it does help me to know that it's not human nature, that we have to have roles or be in a hierarchy. That the old paradigm... Here's one way of saying it, I think. I can imagine a future like the past in which the paradigm was the circle, not the pyramid. There was an idea of connection in a circle with nature, with each other, and in which we were linked, not ranked. We can get back there, I think, in a new way.